Hi, I'm Cutter Wood, author of Earthly Materials, Journeys Through Our Body's Emissions, Excretions, and Disintegrations. In order to live, our bodies continuously shed material, whether it's the mucus that coats and protects the inside of the nose, or the waste we flush down the toilet, or the 20,000 breaths we exhale each and every day. Earthly Materials is about all those things that come out of the human body. The funny thing isn't actually that we shed this material, it's how much effort we often put into pretending we don't. We cough into our elbows and spray air freshener in the bathroom and turn our heads to cry. But if there's one thing I've learned, it's that these materials are fundamental to who we are, both as individuals and as a species. And I'd like to offer 5 insights from my book about what it means to live in a world of bodies. Insight number 1. Civilization begins with waste management. If you could go back 4,000 years or so, the area between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, in what is now modern-day Iraq, you would find some of the largest human settlements the Earth had ever seen. Tens of thousands of people living and working in close proximity. They lived in mud brick structures. They rode on chariots. They played bull's head lyres and worshipped gods with names like An and Ninhursag. They were living, in other words, in what were then relatively new inventions, cities. It was these cities, with their specialization of labor, that allowed human civilization to blossom. And though we often think of civilization in terms of its intellectual achievements, theater, a religion, or writing, these cities relied on something far less cerebral. What you find if you dig down into the ruins of ancient Sumer are some of the very first toilets on Earth. These systems of waste management were nothing like the tubular superhighways that now ferry away and treat the collective effluents of several million people each day in cities like Tokyo and New York. But they still reveal something essential about human civilization. Whether it was the Cloaca Maxima, the great sewer of ancient Rome, or Eugene Belgrand's massive re-engineering of the Paris sewer system in the 19th century, the project of civilization has always been, at its most basic level, about collectively dealing with what comes out of each individual's body. Insight number 2. The body is the politic. Sewer systems are only the most obvious example of the way we cede some of our bodily autonomy in order to coexist in society. In reality, every time we breathe, or cry, or urinate, we're negotiating an uncomfortable, and sometimes untenable truce between our bodies and society. Our lives are governed by a host of laws, social mores, superstitions, and misconceptions about our bodily materials. One of the challenges now, as we've learned more about our bodies, is balancing these personal rights and public responsibilities in a way that's thoughtful and informed. We experienced this firsthand at the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. We've long accepted regulations concerning many of our bodily wastes. There's even a passage in Deuteronomy about how to dig a latrine. But we had never, at a societal level, regulated something like breath. And the process of doing so revealed exactly how difficult these sort of societal negotiations are. The mask became, and remains to this day, a political tinderbox. The need to adjust our behaviors in new and uncomfortable ways will probably only occur with more frequency as our understanding of the body advances. We've learned more about the human body in the past 100 years than we did in the 100,000 preceding. And yet we still often operate according to laws and traditions that date back millennia. We've got a lot of catching up to do. If you swab the mucus on your cheek and send it to a private company to decode your DNA, who owns that information? When your waste flows into a public sewer, whose property is it? These aren't philosophical conundrums. They're real legal questions. Cities across the country now conduct routine wastewater surveillance to track infections. And the bankruptcy of 23andMe has the potential to expose the most sensitive data of millions of people. How we choose to acknowledge and accept the permeability of the human body is going to dictate a lot of how we develop as a society. Insight number 3. You are what you excrete. Part of the reason we are so sensitive about our body's excretions is that they say a lot about who and how we are. Physicians evaluate stool samples using the Bristol Stool Scale to determine a patient's gastrointestinal health, and the spinability of a pregnant woman's cervical mucus is used to estimate her likelihood of experiencing a miscarriage. Laboratory medicine itself began with the study of urine, and urinalysis remains a staple of many doctors' appointments. The hue of urine can be used to diagnose everything from bladder cancer to porphyria, while the scent can indicate diabetes or smoke exposure, or even obscure ailments like maple syrup urine disease. Even the frequency of urination can tell you about a person. During the war in Iraq, for instance, the anxiety of some soldiers manifested as a frequent need to urinate. Possibly the most famous and ubiquitous use of urinalysis, however, is the pregnancy test, though we know it now in the form of the plastic sticks sold in every drugstore across the country. As recently as the 1970s, the process was altogether stranger. It involved a toad. If a woman wanted to know if she was pregnant, she visited her doctor and submitted a urine sample. The sample was then injected into a Xenopus toad, and the toad was placed in a jar atop a perforated platform. The next day, the jar was checked. If the toad had laid eggs, the patient was pregnant. The method was far less convenient and humane than the one we use today, but it did drive home just how potent a cipher our effluence can be for the state of our own organism. It can literally alter the physiology of another animal. Insight number 4. We're more connected than we realize. Set back behind one of the main quadrangles on MIT's campus is the school's biojet lab, what's popularly known as the mucus lab. The scientists here study, as you might expect, mucus, and what they're discovering has the potential to change the entire way we conceptualize ourselves. Our bodies make a lot of mucus, something on the order of a gallon a day. It coats our nasal passages, our eyes, our lungs, our digestive tracts, among other locales. And it's not, as it turns out, just a filter that keeps germs and contaminants from entering our bodies. In fact, its main job seems to be less about keeping things out than keeping them in. In their research, the scientists at the mucus lab have discovered that rather than playing the role of the bouncer, mucus is more like a maitre d'. It plays host to one of the densest ecological communities ever documented, the human microbiome, a living colony of wildly diverse microbes numbering in the thousands of species. Not only are these customers countless, recent estimates give the microbiome 3 times as many cells and far more DNA than the body itself. But some of them, like Staphylococcus aureus, are remarkably virulent. And yet somehow, in ways we're only beginning to understand, mucus feeds them, tames them, and turns them into a functional, commensal community. This microbial community helps to carry out our digestion, creates the sense that we think of as our own, and generally undermines the idea of the body as a simple, single thing. And as if that weren't enough, we're continually trading these microorganisms with one another, connecting us in ways we can't even see, let alone conceptualize. It's really and truly miraculous. And if we can understand how mucus is able to get all these species to cooperate, it may offer us some ideas as to how we can get along as well. Insight number 5. Embrace the mess. The most important insight from earthly materials is also the most basic. We're a mess. Part of living in society is simply accepting that messiness, both others and our own. Our materials have often been an impediment to people coming together, but they don't have to be. In fact, if we illuminate them with understanding and approach them with humility and a sense of humor, we have the opportunity to establish far stronger and more stable connections, both as individuals and as a society. Something I thought of often while writing this book is a story from Richard Burton's version of The 1001 Nights about a man named Abu Hassan who decides to get married. He throws a lavish wedding, stuffed goat, whole roasted camel, 5 kinds of sherbet, and invites everyone in town. After the feasting, his bride enters, and the company, stunned by her beauty, falls silent. Elated, Abu Hassan rises from his divan to greet her, and then he lets slip what Burton calls a great and terrible fart. The man is humiliated. He flees not only the city, but the country, wandering for 10 years, until at last, overcome with homesickness, he decides to return. When he does so, he comes back in disguise, sneaking through the streets for 7 days and seven nights to see whether his transgression has been forgotten. Having at last satisfied himself that it has, he's finally on his way to return home when he passes the door of a hut and hears a girl asking her mother what day she was born. "My daughter," says the mother, "you were born on the night Abu Hassan farted." The man flees once more, never to return. It's funny, of course, not because of the fart, but because of Abu Hassan's reaction. People fart all the time. It wasn't the fart that ruined his life. It was his response to it. The whole thing reminds me of an old Sumerian proverb. Because not only were the Sumerians some of the first to live in cities, they were also the first to master writing. In a scribal school in the city of Nippur, archaeologists discovered a clay fragment bearing what is now recognized as the first joke ever recorded. It translates loosely as follows. "What has never happened since time immemorial? Someone didn't fart in their lover's lap." It's strange to say, but I think there's a great deal of wisdom in that joke. We would do well to remember that no matter how high we build our skyscrapers, or how far we peer into the cosmos, we always have one thing in common. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy the book.